our contemplation of the Dharma, our practice of meditation, beginning each moment, each session, with this orientating our attention to connecting with how it is, here and now, coming into relationship through the activity of mindfulness, present moment awareness, with what is here for us, the flow of the breath, sensations in the body, the mood in the heart, whether we feel constricted, contracted, expansive, light, heavy. In this practice of mindfulness, of attention, we begin to replace the reactivity to what's present, the reactivity of judging, liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting, all of the ways we move around the present moment, moving away, wishing something else was here, being distracted, fantasizing, resisting, all of those which generate a subtle or more profound sense of dukkha, struggle, dis-ease, the avijja of the mind, the ignorance of the mind in relationship to the present moment, the wanting what's not here, the wanting something else. Wanting what's not here, the not wanting what is here. All of this we begin to replace with just this capacity for mindfulness, for attention, for this is how it is. Replacing our reactivity with moments of awareness, moments of awareness that's in contact, but also is discerning, is open and receptive, but also discerning. How is it? That's inquiry, that's curious. So this more reflective style of meditation we sometimes call vipassana, although actually the word vipassana is hardly used in the suttas. It's not, somehow it's emerged as a whole school and a whole tradition almost. She really emerged from the forests of Burma. The practice of what we now call vipassana originated in Burma and developed as a method or a technique of holding attention to sensation, to vedana, sweeping the attention through the body. But in a way, this is this vipassana, that this word that we use and sometimes trip over, what does it mean exactly? It wasn't that commonly used by the Buddha. It just really meant insight, seeing into. What was more a refrain that comes again and again in the suttas is the core of, or the support for the meditative practice, or this reflective type of practice, is this word sati. Which we translate in English, I'm not sure how you translate in Hebrew, which is translated commonly as mindfulness. Sati sampajanya, mindfulness. My teacher translates sati sampajanya as intuitive awareness, which gives a sort of a softer or more fluid sense of contact with the present moment. So it's not so much just a technique, a method, but this somehow opening and intuiting what is here, what is present for us. Or this word I used yesterday, yonisomanisakara, which is means reflection or wise reflection or contemplating, fathoming almost, taking into the womb of awareness whatever emerges in our present moment experience for the sake of contemplation, reflection. So last night Kittisaro talked about the four ennobling truths. When we bring awareness, this capacity for mindfulness, often what we experience, what we bring it to is this, one of the aspects that we bring our awareness to is this experience of dukkha. However we sense it, whenever it emerges. And dukkha or suffering in a particular way, it's not saying, this first noble truth is not saying that the freedom from dukkha means that we never feel pain or we never feel discomfort or we never feel doubt or we never are anguished. But it's the relationship, it's the that which generates dukkha, that which brings this sense of struggle, is the avijja, the ignorance of the mind. The ignoring, the not seeing how it is, the projection of the mind onto the present moment from rather than a direct relationship through mindfulness to how it is, this projection of the mind that struggles. It should be another way. I don't want what's here. Basically, Ajahn Chah called it the wanting and the not wanting of the mind. Being here, sitting here, but wanting to be somewhere else. Being somewhere else, but wanting to be here. So as we start to contemplate, if there's a sense of struggle or dis-ease, some feeling of dukkha, then that same quality of attention that we've been holding to the breath in the samatha meditation, in the calming meditation, breathing in, breathing out, being with the bodily, focusing, gathering, we can bring that mindfulness, that attention, that awareness to contemplate, to fathom, to yonisomanisakara, to bring into the womb of our awareness this experience of dukkha, rather than interpreting the experience of struggle or suffering as something wrong with me or something wrong with the world or denying it or distracting from it, repressing it or wallowing in it. Poor me, no one suffers as much as me, that kind of relationship that we can have. We we often, with this experience of suffering, we immediately interpret it as something to do with me. It's my fault, or it's something wrong, or I'm failing. Or the world, if I can just get the world right, then I won't experience this disease, this conflict, this suffering. If I can just move the conditions of my life in the right place, just get the right, the room right, the relationships right, the work right, the friendships right. So it's a bit like those Rubik's cubes. You kind of juggle life trying to get everything perfect, everything right. so we won't feel this experience of disease. And this is our modern world is very committed to that agenda. It's a billion-dollar industry to remove, distract ourselves from this fundamental experience of dukkha. And so many different ways. Just get everything as pleasant as possible. So there's something, for me, was something of a relief when I first heard this teaching. It's because I would personalize this experience so much. It's something deeply flawed about me because I feel this sense of fear or anxiety, lack of confidence, insecurity. However one feels this experience of dukkha, but to actually have this just articulated, the way that the Buddha articulated, he didn't say the world is suffering, actually, which is often how it's translated. Buddhists believe the world is a part of suffering. That wasn't the way it was articulated, which is a bit of a depressing message. The world is what it is. It has its beauty, it has its many different manifestations. It's something, what he how it's articulated was just very simply this: there is this experience of dukkha and it needs to be contemplated. There is this experience of struggle, unsatisfactoriness, dis-ease in the heart. We don't aim as ones who are reflecting on this First Noble Truth, we don't aim to fix it, to even necessarily understand it, to sort it out, to change the world, although we might do that. But first of all, we just contemplate it. We open the mind, the awareness, the attention to contemplate this experience. So we can check it out in any moment during the day as we practice today. If we feel a sense of dukkha, we're not reacting to it, we're not trying to repress it, we're just not distracting ourselves, but we locate it and say, there is this experience now of discomfort, dis-ease, struggle. What's generating it? Can I explore the Second Noble Truth? Can I explore? Is the circumstance really suffering? Or is it my relationship to it? Where is really the suffering? It's not to say that there isn't things that are painful or difficult, but where is this extra suffering that we project, that the mind is projecting? It's not that someone's doing it to us. It's not that. It's like what is the mind, the ignorance of the mind, projecting into this moment that's generating this sense of unsatisfactoriness? And if we look deeply, we might just begin to uncover this Second Noble Truth, this sense of actually in each moment there's I'm resisting, I'm not wanting. Or I'm wanting what's not here. It's very simply put, these three tanhas, or these three kinds of thirsts that we can reflect on. And all of these truths, they're not esoteric, difficult things to contemplate. We experience them every day. We experience them here and now in our everyday life. The first of these tanha, I talked a little bit about yesterday, this craving or this wanting through the senses some pleasant experience, some ideal experience. The seeking for that. So the kamma tanha. We sit in the shade and then we move to the sun and we move to the sun and it's a bit too hot, so we go back inside again, and then it's a bit too cool and we don't like it here because it's a bit too crowded, so we go off on our own under the tree, and then we get lonely, and then we want to talk to our friend, and then we go and wander off and find our friend, and our friend doesn't really understand us, and then so we have to go and find the mobile phone to call someone, and we call them and they're busy and they're a bit dismissive, and then we get sort of a bit upset and go off and sit under the tree again, and then it's too cold, and kind of, you know, this sort of wandering around trying to find the right spot. I remember when one of the teachers that influenced us, Kirisa and I, very much, is a Chinese master, Master Hua. He's passed over now, but when he was elderly, he was a refugee from the communism in China, and left in as that communism swept through and Buddhism was swept out of China pretty much. He left to escape that and came to America. And eventually he brought some of his sangha, his monks and nuns, to visit us in the UK. And he arrived at the airport in London, and Kirisara went up to him, kind of all enthusiastic and like this master, this great master. He was incredibly impressive Chinese master, Zen master. Sort of bounded up to him. And what do you say to a master? I mean, he suddenly was there in front of this guy, this monk. And so Kirisara said, do you like it here? It's a great opening line. And Master Hua said, I like it everywhere. So that when the heart, you know, it's said that when the mind or the heart doesn't know this primordial awareness as its true home, the suchness of our being, when we don't really recognize that, this third noble truth, when we don't really recognize and rest in this primordial awareness, being nature, suchness, which is available to us in every moment, then there's this leaning into this sense of something that I need, something that's needed, something extra, something that we, a sense of something that we have to follow, to build upon, to move towards. So the seed of these tanhas, these three movements of tanha, arise from this inability really to, or this lack of realization around where to find our resting place, where to find a sense of our true home. When we begin to connect with that through this activity of mindfulness, then wherever we are, then yeah, we can say, I like everywhere. Everywhere. We know that we can be with how it is, contemplate how it is. But before that, we just throw the delusion of the mind as well. If I just get it right, get to the right place, then I'll feel good. And then, you know, conversely, the vipawa tanha, it's like when we've had enough sensory experience, when we've tasted enough, there's something that comes up that just wants to shut down, go unconscious, not feel anything anymore. It's just too difficult to be here. This is called the vipawa tanha. As it, at its most extreme, it's the desire not to exist. I don't know if you've ever had that. I've had quite a lot of that, actually. I just kind of wish I wasn't here, actually. Truth be known, it's all, as Kirisara said last night, our mantra is all a bit too difficult most of the time. where's the delete button? But, you know, here we are, or here I am, you know, in my incarnation, and trying to wake up to it. So this deep sense of weariness or deep sense of just wanting to avoid, not to really be that conscious, to just get through somehow and hope some, you know, get to the next resting place, the next, you know, crash point. I can just hide, escape. It's called vipuwa dhanha. You know, the sense of just wanting to close down, that contact is painful. This is, I think a lot of meditators probably have a lot of vipuwa dhanha in some ways. You know, just wrap myself up and disappear from this world. So this, you know, this, and then the third form, if that wasn't enough, the first two forms of tanha, the third one is called bawa tanha, which is this very powerful sense of becoming something that drives us on. It's becoming a perfect meditator, becoming holy, becoming wise, becoming spiritual, becoming good at qigong, becoming a good Dhamma teacher, not screwing up and saying things that you think, God, did I say that? I can't believe I said that. You know, becoming our ambitions, what we desire to become. You know, and it's not, all of these in some ways are quite innocent desires. They seem quite innocent. Then it's not that they're bad, or they just delude us. And it's not that these energies of tanha, that we can't, you know, we purify them and direct that energy. You know, we can talk a bit about that before we leave the retreat. It's like we need that energy, but it's when it's not illuminated by mindfulness, by sati sampajanya, by wisdom, then we just get shaped and driven. And then wonder why we still feel, even when we become what we want to become, why am I still suffering? I remember a friend of ours in South Africa who's a head of one of the mining companies, and a very successful businessman. And Kirisar and him went to university together, in the same university. That's how the relationship grew. Then when we went to live and work in South Africa 12 years ago, we reconnected. And by that time, he'd gone in very idealistically into the mining industry to want to change the labor laws and help black empowerment and all of this, and just landed up really ultimately being consumed into the system and become more cynical by the time we met him again towards the end of his working life, and had become very successful, very wealthy, lots of ability to access pleasure of the sense world, travel here, travel there, beautiful home, beautiful wife, and so on. And he would invite us to these dinner parties, Joburg dinner parties. A little bit excruciating for with mining CEOs, bankers, you know, gold traders. It's kind of a slightly strange company for Buddhist meditator, but anyhow, it was very interesting. And his friend, he would sit around and people would sort of just knock back a couple of bottles of wine and, you know, slightly soften up and open up a bit, and you could actually get to talk to them, relax. And I remember one day I was sitting next to this friend and one of these dinner parties, and he was a bit more relaxed because your mind, this razor sharp mind you developed, you know, just very defended actually, this incredible mind, powerful mind. And he'd gotten a little more soft and open. We were talking, and he just started to tell me that, you know, you go into work, and you'd have to sort of speculate what's going to happen in the gold market, and, you know, how do you invest, and, you know, what, you know, it's like Russian roulette, really. You just put you know, a few million dollars here and hope that this is going to happen and that stock is going to do something. I mean, I don't understand that world, but anyway, just move stuff around. And it was just very stressful. So I said, wow, you know, it sounds pretty stressful. You know, what happens as a result of doing all of that? And he said, well, you know, I just get nightmares. He said, I repress. There's an enormous amount of fear to go into that and have to keep up this bravado, this front of being really, you know what you're doing. Which he did, and he was being very, very clever. And I said, it's incredibly frightening, but I just, he was very honest, just repress, really very self-reflective actually, just repress all the fear so I can do it. So, but then at night I'd have all these nightmares, you know, and just come up with all these nightmares. And, I said to him, well, you know, that sounds pretty difficult. When do you get to stop? You know, when do you get to get a break? When do you get to to be able to take out? And his reply was kind of interesting for me. It's quite staggering, really. He said, "Well, when I'm successful." Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what is success? How do we rate that? And when do we get there? You know, it's for most people, worldly terms, you kind of made it. And yet there was this very, very deep feeling of, I haven't really made it yet. You know, I mean, is it like Bill Gates? Is that what it is? What is it? And when do we get there? And, how high is the bar? And even those that get there, what, you know, do they feel? Can they enjoy this success? So this Bala Tanha is very powerful. It's so powerful in our society. It shapes so much. It drives us on. And then we translate some of that into our spiritual life. You know, we can never quite meditate enough. We can never quite do enough practices. You know, this is called Sila Bhakti Paramasa, which means, you know, belief in rites and rituals. If we just do enough rituals, enough rites, meditate long enough retreats, you know, then maybe we might deserve to get there. We might allow ourselves to arrive into our lives, into our awareness, into our presence, into our awakeness. This Bhava Tanha, this Vipava Tanha, Kamma Tanha, these three forms of this, the Second Noble Truth, that move and shape us all the time. In the mindfulness practice, we just bring moments of mindfulness. This is how it is. This is what it feels like to sit here and feel either I want something more, you know, something to eat, see, some distraction, want to watch a movie, want to escape. I sit here and just feel like I don't really want to be here, I just want to disappear. Or I sit here and I just, you know, just feel like it's not enough. Got to become something, my aims, my ambitions. And we just start to illuminate those forces, those powerful forces of Tanha with moments of mindfulness, moments of just seeing this is how it is. And then the remedy to just let those forces be, let it be, or let it go. It's not to say, as I just mentioned, we might not pick up that energy and channel it illuminated by wisdom and compassion, but first of all we're just getting a sense of what is it to just not be shaped by those forces of becoming. And then, you know, the moments of letting go, letting be, just letting it exactly as it is now, without having to juggle anything, shift anything, get it right, fix it, understand it, find meaning in it, sort it out, interpret it, place it, avoid it, resist it. Just this is how it is, this is how it is, this is just like this. Moments of letting things be, there can be the letting go, the non-grasping of the mind. This is the third truth. The moments of just recognizing that there is that which is just present. the awareness of the heart that's forever present, just being. It's hard for us sometimes to have confidence in that, because in some ways it's a place of unknowing. It's not a place of, you know, where the sense of self can put a flag and own. It's a stripping away. It's a letting go of that which we know, to just rest in the unknowingness of awareness. It has a quality of knowing, but it's a knowing of the unknowing. I don't know if that makes sense, but then in terms of how it actually is experienced and tasted. So our teachers would say, to help us get a sense for this nirodha, this non-grasping, this third noble truth, the underlying peacefulness, it encourages us to notice things that we don't usually notice. We usually notice the forms. We come into a room like this and we sort of scan the room, and there's this person and that person. We might have different responses to different people. I like this one, I don't like that one, I'm a bit threatened by that one, I'm a bit unsure of that one. We don't even know each other sometimes. We have all these perceptions. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, the mind? And so we kind of come in and we focus on the forms, our like, our dislike, but we don't really notice the space. If there wasn't any space here, we couldn't sit here. So like last night, Kirisara was saying that the analogy, you know, for the depth of the mind, the mind ground, for the depth of awareness, noticing the waves, noticing the change, the sounds, each sound, it arises and it passes back into silence, into stillness. Each form emerges into the space and dissolves back into spaciousness. Each physical form, each building, everything that's created comes from the formless and then dissolves back into the formless, comes into form and then back into formlessness. So one way to help us recognize this underlying nirodha, non-created, the uncreated, the unborn, the unoriginated, the place of deathlessness, place of peace, is to just notice the spaciousness and the internal spaciousness. We get very fixated on thoughts, on feelings, on ideas, on my views, on my sense of self. But there's also an internal space, the awareness of the heart, that which is receiving, that which is listening, that which is knowing. So the Buddha, in one of his teachings, there's a story that a disciple came to the Buddha called Bahiya, and the Buddha was arms round, and Bahiya came to him and the Buddha and said, "Give me a teaching." And the Buddha said, "Well, this isn't the right time. I'm on arms round. Come later." And Bahiya was pretty insistent, said, "No, life is impermanent, sir. Give me a teaching." And Bahiya asked three times, and it said, if you ask a Buddha three times, then they have to respond, so you keep on. And the Buddha gave this very famous teaching, which was, well, Bahiya, in the seen is just the seen, in the heard is just the heard, in the sensed or the felt is just the sensed or the felt, in the cognized or the thought is just the thought. Contemplate thus. And then it said that Bahiya kind of got it, bowed, walked away, and then got gored by a bull and died. So I guess he knew his number was up and he wanted to get something quick, so he was right. These really unusual stories in the sutras. Did that really happen? Life is a bit strange, isn't it? This is also a teaching that helps us open to this deathless element, this nibbida, nibbana, niroda. To see, when we see something, like, you know, we see, look out and I see a tree, and it's just seeing, isn't it? Then I start to think about trees and the environment and the ecology and how we're chopping them down, and the mind starts to proliferate, and, you know, what am I doing sitting here? I should go be an eco-warrior and tie myself up in the top of a tree and demonstrate. And, you know, we're just standing there looking at a tree, and the next thing we created is called papancha. The mind creates a world, and then we, guess who's the central character, you know, in the drama that the mind has just manifested. You know, usually it's, you know, us, isn't it? We're sort of like the hero or the heroine or in the central act. So in the seeing, when we just see, there's just even the word tree. So having moments of just seeing, moments of just seeing, it's just that. Moments of just hearing. Can hear, you know, the other day the military plane. I assume it was that. And mind starts proliferating about, oh my God, the Middle East, and, you know, we're going to have a nuclear meltdown in a minute, and what's going to happen in Iraq, and God, Iran, and America, and Jesus, these guys, what are they doing? And, you know, the next thing, I'm writing a letter to, you know, W. Dear W. I won't tell you what's in the letter, it's unrepeatable. Anyway, so you just, like, find the mind just hearing a sound, and the next thing I'm kind of in the middle of the Armageddon. I find this is such a helpful teaching. It's not to say that these aren't issues and that these aren't realities, but it's just to maintain that stability and that insight. What is actually happening here? What's real and what's generated from the creation of the mind? In the felt is just the felt. Feeling is so powerful. Pleasant, unpleasant. When in a conflict I was involved in recently in South Africa, it was very painful. Lots of different views and emotions, and it was sort of had a sort of racial element to it. A very, very difficult situation. And I felt very difficult feelings around emotion, a lot of emotional feelings. Everyone was very highly emotive. I just contemplate. We can create such a surround feeling, particularly negative feelings, such a strong perception of self and other, right and wrong. And so just being able to contemplate, this is within the feeling, it's just unpleasant feeling. The feeling of aversion, it's like this. And more subtly, in the thinking mind, you know, the thoughts, the papancha, the proliferation of mind, to be able to have moments of seeing, you know, I like this, I don't like this, I want it to be different. Moments of just seeing, can we just see, this is thought. Slowing a thought down. I don't like this. I want to go. You know, these very powerful thoughts. It's not to say that might not be true and that might not be what we need to do, but if we haven't got perspective on our thinking mind, then we just, you know, any impulse comes and we just move with it. Move here, move there, and we never released. So to have moments just seeing this is thought. So as we explore this letting go, this spaciousness, letting be, our mindfulness practice, Sati Sampajanya, things will come up. It's called Sankara, old patterns. A lot of meditation, we're just dealing with the residue, the habits of the mind. Things that we've invested a lot of energy in. Fears, desires, aversions, views. These shapes of the tanhas, the thirst. A lot of that is just what will come up for us. So one needs a lot of patience with what our experience is. Just being very patient. I remember when one of my deep sankharas, sankhara just means patterns or tendency, how the self, the sense of self is shaped. What we've invested in, how we feel ourselves to be. Some of these are very deep. Some of these senses of how we're shaped are very deep. For example, one that's very strong for me, and I think it's very communal, is the sense of fear. It might just come up as anxiety. But you know, underneath a... You know, this pervasive sense of fear. And I practice with that quite a lot. And it would come up in certain situations. Ironically, one of them is public speaking. So I've had lots of practice. Other things. When I lived as a nun, we had to walk from the main hall back to my resting place. At one point, I lived... We ran out of space. There was a lot of women that wanted to join the order, and we just had this small dwelling. We ran out of space, so I made this, it's called a bender tent. It's like a gypsy tent. I lived in the forest that was adjacent to the monastery. And I'd walk there at night, and I'd just be, really have quite a lot of fear come up. And I noticed if I had a torch on, then I would feel like a flashlight. I would feel okay, there's some light. And then I'd switch it off, and then the mind would just throw up all these kind of crazy images. So I'd practice, I'd hold the light on, and then switch it off. And then breathe, do my mantra, do my mantra, and then switch it on. Kind of like just... And then I thought, no, this is no good. I've just got to force the issue, you know, really confront this terror. Sit out all night in the forest on my own, that will do it. So I went, fortunately, I took myself to my meditation teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, and said, look, I've got this plan. I'm going to sort of, you know, this is like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. I'm not moving until I've conquered. I'm going to take on fear. This is my idea. I'm going to go out and sit all night in the forest and really feel the terror and meet it and hopefully overcome it. And my teacher had more wisdom than me. Clearly, I have very little wisdom, really. But he just said, you know, don't do that. He said, you know, these things, they fall away in their own time. You know, you just meet it in moments. Just meet the edge of it in moments and let it fall away in its own time. You know, these kind of big heroic showdowns aren't the way. They're not the way of integration. They might be the way to really catapult us into an extreme state, but it's not the way of true integration. So when we do practice, and for many of us, we'll feel the residue coming up of, you know, like not wanting to be here, resistance, fear, longings, different things will come up in the mind, in the heart, in the body. Just this welcoming, and can I just be with how it is? You know, not struggle, not generate more dukkha by wishing it was some other way. And just to meet the edge of it in this moment, we just do it moment by moment, and trusting that as we replace our reactivity, with moments of mindfulness, moments of inquiry, moments of just what's happening here, breathing with it, that the mindfulness of awareness itself is that which brings about release, brings about resolve, brings about healing, brings about integration. So these are just words. Some of them may be helpful, some of them not. And the important thing in this practice is to maintain our own discernment, what works for us, what doesn't. Ajahn Chah would always say after he spoke, well, if you can take something and work with it, that's great. If not, just leave it with the speaker. They're just words. Words ultimately aren't the way, they're just pointers. The problem with words is they become views. Ajahn Chah once gave this story. He said it's like, you know, if you see a disciple going too far, you know, walking down the road and they're about to fall in a ditch and they're going too far to the right, you say, go left. So the disciple very dutifully writes down, go left. So you see another disciple walking down there and he starts to fall into the ditch on the left. You go, go right. So the disciple goes, go right. So then the two disciples get together and say, no. He said, go left. No, go right. So this is how it is. This is the difficulty. It's such a complicated world, Buddhist world. Every world is complicated. But the world of words. So one has to hold them lightly, really. It's not to abdicate responsibility of words. They're all so powerful. But really, ultimately, the teachings, as is said in the Chinese school, they're provisional. They emerge in response to human ignorance. In the world of awakenedness, there are no words. There are no teachings. There are no ways. They're about just bringing us into balance and so that we can taste for ourselves directly the peacefulness of our own heart. As the Zen master Huang Po said, although the Buddha talked for 40 years, he didn't say a word. I really like that.